So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are very welcome to the 18th extraordinary meeting of the 154th session of the Literary and Historical Society, the public business of which is the presentation of the honorary fellowship to Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Before we begin the event, it falls to me to introduce our interview for this evening, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce from Ortiz The Week in Politics, a person who covered the first democratic elections in South Africa, Mr. Sean O'Rourke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Auditor Ian. It's an absolute privilege and a joy for me to be invited to have this conversation with Archbishop Tutu here in University College Dublin this evening. I'm not going to waste time outlining his long and distinguished background. I'm simply going to quote two sentences from a book called Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. And when he was writing about, first of all, the day of his release from Robben Island, I think the place he went to stay on the first night of freedom was at Archbishop's house. And he just referred to him as somebody who selflessly fought the evils of racism during the terrible days of apartheid. And then earlier, when Archbishop Tutu became a Nobel laureate, when he won the Nobel Prize for Peace, he wanted to send him a letter of congratulations. And there was obviously obstruction by the authorities on the delivery of that letter. But he said, here was a man who had inspired an entire nation with his words and his courage, who had revived the people's hope during the darkest of times. Would you welcome, please, Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Thank you.
We're going to let this conversation range a little bit, and we will have time for some questions from the audience, but I know because you confirmed it to me just a few minutes ago, Archbishop Tutu, that you were in Washington for the inauguration of President Obama. What do you think of that man, and what does his election represent for you?
Yes. May I be able to say good evening? Hello. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I'm always energized by young people. I went to Washington, D.C., invited by the Black Congressional Caucus Foundation to preach at a pre-inauguration service. And I thought I was going to get a VIP'd. I wasn't. I got a ticket for a seat around where the whole thing was going to be happening, and went with my son-in-law with very fondly thought, oh, we'd be able to get in, we've got tickets. It was impossible. I mean, people were wedged just like that, and there were moments when you couldn't put your hands in your pocket. He energized, galvanized so many people, especially young people, and it was palpable. I mean, the excitement, the joy, the pride. I mean, Americans walked tall for a very long, they hadn't done that for a very long time. And one of our friends said, you know, I was actually waving an American flag. This is an American who says, previously I burned those flags. he's filled the world with a new sense of hope that our world can actually become a better place. And for those of us of color, we have a new spring in our walk. We walk with our shoulders slightly straighter than they were a while ago. And it's like he's saying, we're not God's stepchildren. But he's filled many, many people. You remember when he went to Berlin, 200,000 Germans turned out to welcome him. That especially young people like you, the disillusionment that you have sometimes felt about politics has just evaporated, and you see, yes, we can make this a better world. And for a young person like himself, I can say that. I mean, anything younger than 60 is very young. he has an extraordinary gravitas, don't you think? You know, he seems quite calm, and is very measured. He's not like, I mean, I throw about my arms and I'm very ebullient and so forth. He's very smart, and his wife is.
Wives tend to be like that, Archbishop Tudor.
Yes, I wish I was younger.
He's got a lot of problems to address. I don't know how much time he has for other things, but on the world, on a world agenda, as it were, I suppose a lot of people looking to the Middle East. Now, I think it's about 7 years since you wrote after visiting the Holy Land that Israel will never get true security and safety through oppressing another people. You wrote that in 2002. Do you think President Obama's arrival is going to make much difference to a problem which has got worse in the intervening time?
Yes, I don't remember that I said it quite that way.
It's a quote from The Guardian. It must be true.
Yes, no, I've said, I mean, that our own experience in South Africa is that there's no way in which you're ever going to get true security from the barrel of a gun. We found it home, I mean, as everybody is going to find. They are going to find in the Middle East that eventually they're going to have to sit down. We found at home that ultimately the thing we were so hungry for would come not by denigrating people, not by rubbing their noses in the dust, but it was when you acknowledge their inalienable rights, the inalienable rights of everyone, that eventually, I mean, we can write the recent history of the Middle East, certainly of the Holy Land. It's, you get a suicide bomber doing something that is utterly unacceptable. And you know as sure as anything that there is going to be a reprisal. And then you know that after that reprisal, there is going to be another act. And you see, that is the kind of thing that we said at home. And when I said, there is no future without forgiveness.
But looking at the situation now, there are more hardliners in positions of leadership on both sides of that conflict than there were at any time, I think, in the recent past. So what is going to unlock that?
May I point out, actually, that, you know, sometimes all of us forget this. You talk about hardliners, yes, and that's a fact of the landscape. And yet, you see, you've got to keep remembering that within Israel, there are very many who are saying, not in my name. There are young people who refuse to serve in the army because of their consciences. There are, I think every, I don't know which day of the week, but there are women, the women in black who survived the Holocaust, who go to the checkpoints, and they stand there in a vigil to see what treatment is being meted out to the Palestinians. And equally, on the other side, there are very, very many who are eager to find an accommodation. So you do have those hardliners. Yeah, I mean, there's a thing called the parent circle. I don't know whether you've heard of it. It's made up of parents on both sides who have lost children as a result of the of all of the turmoil and unrest, and they meet as parents who have been bereaved. And now, just add all of those groups and say, what is their significance? What is their impact on what is taking place? And in the United States, yeah, you know, I mean, that it's pretty tough there. I've always been amazed at how people will say, if you raise the question of the treatment of the Palestinians, and you say it is wrong that you are said to be anti-Semitic, and you say, actually, of course, I mean, the Palestinians are also Semites. If you think I'm for, I'm not for the Palestinians, as I'm not against the Israelis. I am for justice. And tough luck. I can't help it. I mean, it's not for me a choice.
Right. Well, you talked earlier, I think, about a spirit of forgiveness, Archbishop Tutu, and that is something I think which anybody who has ever been to South Africa or who has met South Africans,
yes,
you personify yourself as indeed does President Mandela, a lack of bitterness, despite having an awful lot of things to be bitter about, and vengeance did not seem to be on the agenda in the aftermath of apartheid. So is that something that can somehow be bottled and exported, if I can put it like that?
Yes. Nelson Mandela is obviously the spectacular example. But in fact, you know, I wish we could tell the many stories of the so-called ordinary people. There are no ordinary people in my theology. Everyone is an extraordinary human being created in the image of God. But it's those people who have usually been regarded as a small people, the little people. And of all races, you see, do you think it can be bottled? Well, I was part of a program, BBC program, Facing the Truth in Northern Ireland. And we were a panel of three, one Scottish woman and an American professor. And we had people from both sides in the troubles, both victim and perpetrator. And many, many times you were just bowled over by the incredible generosity of spirit. It's not copyright or trademark, except this. We've been trying to say one of the gifts we may be giving to the world is our conception of what it takes to be human. On the whole, Westerners tend to be individualistic. And it's not anything you want to kick, because it has very many good attributes. But our sense of what it takes to be human is that you can't be human in isolation. You can't be human as a solitary being. We say a person is a person through other persons. As all of us know, I mean, we didn't come into the world fully formed and fully equipped so that we could speak languages. We learned how to speak by learning, imitating. We learned how to walk as human beings because we saw other human beings do it. So we belong in this network of interdependence. And actually that is, it's biblical too. And that is what we would hope we can, if you want to export, remind people that we are made for togetherness, and we muck things up horrendously if we break this law of our interdependence.
Which I suppose is as good a cue as we get to talk about the situation in Zimbabwe. Now again, you were very outspoken, have always been outspoken for very many years about Robert Mugabe. You warned, I think at the start of the last decade, sorry, of this decade, that Zimbabwe was sliding into dictatorship. More recently, you described him as a Frankenstein. Clearly, you have been frustrated with, as yes. you would see it, the lack of leadership on the part of South Africa's president and governing authority to deal more effectively with him. So yeah. What's your current assessment?
Yeah. I think we are all going to have to do a great deal of knee drill. Knee drill, knee drill, knee drill. Bending down and praying. The only show on the road at the moment is that agreement. It doesn't look, I mean, when you make an objective assessment, it doesn't look like it stands a snowball's chance in hell. But it could, it just might work. And the important thing is that it is the Zimbabweans who have said, we want to go this way. And I hope we can give them all the support we possibly can. Because the people have suffered so grievously for so long, and the elders have called on the international community to really speed up humanitarian assistance to a country that was such a beautiful country.
Why do you think the South African government, and particularly President Mbeki when he was there, were so reluctant to criticize,
yes.
were so reluctant to take action?
I think I said to him on one occasion that I understood his reluctance, the constraints that he had. One of them is that I think a number of the other countries have felt that South Africa was an upstart. I mean, we are the new kid on the block, and here we come along and we are laying down, trying to lay down the law for everybody. And I think that there has been a resentment about an apparent arrogance on the part of the South Africans. But you know, I think it goes a little further back, that Robert Mugabe used to be the star turn. As you can see, I mean, he's very articulate. He's very debonair. I mean, he dresses and you see the cuff links and things. And always the media rushed to him when there was a meeting of the heads of state in Africa. And then here comes an old man after 27 years in jail. And you know, the media had no subtlety at all. They dropped Robert like a hot potato, and all dashed to this old. It's pretty tough.
But I mean, people like Kenneth Kaunda got over things like that.
Well, you know, there may be some. I can't imagine, I mean, that when I have been first fiddle and you come along and you shove me to the back of the queue, I'm not sure that I'm going to be too Christian about how I feel. But you see, with Nelson Mandela, Robert Mugabe could rationalize it by saying, well, this is an old man and he's been in jail. Thabo comes along, he's much younger, and was not in jail, he was in exile, and exile is not anything to compare with the deprivations of jail. And that was a constraint. And then Robert Mugabe married a younger woman.
Mandela married a younger woman also.
No. She's...
You performed the wedding ceremony. I've seen the video.
No. I didn't. I told Nelson Mandela, you are setting a very bad example to young people. Get married. Don't shack with make a decent woman of her.
This is Madame Michelle.
Yes, she's just fantastic. I mean, I pull a leg here now and again and say, this is the only woman who has slept with two presidents and nobody worries.
Coming back, you mentioned Thabo Mbeki there, with whom I suppose you had had a fairly robust relationship. I mean, you didn't just criticize him over South Africa, you criticized him over elitism within the ANC,
yes,
over his AIDS policy. Was he a disappointment to you then as president?
He is very gifted, but in many ways I think he was English. He didn't carry his heart on his sleeves. And so didn't easily engage with people. There was a bit of being sort of standoffish. And I think, I mean, part of how Jacob Zuma has stolen the march on him is that Jacob Zuma is a people's person. And really is able to engage people. And yet you see, Thabo is He's a very engaging person when you sort of one-on-one.
But in terms of where South Africa is at now, 15 years on, we'll say, from the first democratic elections, how has the reality matched up or otherwise to your hopes and expectations?
I believe, that we were many of us unrealistic in our expectations. we thought that we would having left bondage, crossed the Red Sea, we didn't remember that there was a 40-year sojourn in the wilderness. When the ones who had left Egypt were wrangling and quarreling, and some of them had a nostalgia for Egypt and its flesh pots. We didn't, what got us was that during the struggle, our people were really fantastic. I mean, you could say 99% of the people were altruistic. None said, "I am in this for what I can get out of it." And we imagined that idealism, that being there for other people, would carry automatically into the post-apartheid. What we discovered is that original sin actually knows nothing about color.
Snuffs in the trough.
Yes, blacks succumb to the same kind of temptations as the people they had struggled against.
Yeah, we're big on original sin in this country as well, as you probably know, certainly in political spheres. But coming back to the situation, the ANC, as of now, seems to be divided. According to some observers, its main preoccupation is to prevent Jacob Zuma going on trial for corruption. There's this breakaway group forming with the supporters of Thabo Mbeki. So how stable do you think, say, South Africa is going to be over the next 5-10 years? Would you worry at all about it possibly going the same direction as Zimbabwe? I mean, that's looking at it in extremis, I know, but how confident are you in the next generation of leaders?
I am constantly amazed, actually, when you think of where we come from. It's amazing that we have the kind of stability that we do have. I had very fondly thought, I could make a suggestion, which was that apartheid devastated not just South Africa, but Southern Africa, and that a very good argument could be made for our being given a special kind of Marshall Plan to help us get back on our feet. Because Europe didn't make it on its own. There was that massive support from the United States. Because just now, our government has to deal with the normal expectations of contemporary society, but has also got to be making up for the incredible deficits apartheid deliberately gave black people an inferior education, deliberately didn't build homes in the townships, deliberately had a discriminatory health system. And so you've got to say that they have not done too badly given the constraints. That they had to make up all of the lacks, the deficits of apartheid, and also be able to build, we've got something called the Gautrain, which we hope is going to link the airport, international airport, with the city. Some of the things we were stupid about. I mean, I think that it is unconscionable that we should have had the kind of policy we had on AIDS, that many people died who needn't have died. But you know, I've been a teacher, and I could give a report card and say, this student is doing reasonably well, but there is room for improvement.
Well, now, talking of economic progress and aid and so forth, there are people, I think it's fairly clear, say, here in Ireland and the Irish government, who are looking at the overseas aid budget and saying, well, look, maybe there are no votes for us in far-off places, be they in Africa or Southern America or wherever, and they're saying, let's cut the aid budget a bit more. I mean, they're cutting it already by 95 million euro this year, but there are people perhaps saying, we should cut it more and spend it on our own needs. What would you say to them, Archbishop Tutu?
Just this, that, I mean, if this meltdown has caused as much turmoil and difficulties here, in the home of the Celtic tiger, can you imagine what the impact must be for those who have been, in any case, at the margins of international society, the weak, the vulnerable? You see the thing that I said at the beginning, that we belong together. And in an extraordinary kind of way, protectionism actually doesn't work. It is self-defeating. You need those people out there for them to be your trade partners.
And so would something like cutting the aid budget, would that amount to protectionism, a different kind of protectionism, say, to putting up trade barriers?
I would myself say I don't want it either or. Get rid of both.
Sure. Now, again, we're talking about economic uncertainty. A lot of fear and danger in the world from all sorts of sources at the present time. People losing their jobs, people struggling to get jobs. Again, a lot of people in this room who may be on the point of graduating or who are thinking about getting into the labour market, 12 or 18 months ago, you would have been guaranteed a choice of jobs. Now, you might be lucky to have even one, or you might have to look at life as an immigrant or going on the dole or whatever. Again, what do you say to the people before you were in that situation?
These are fantastic young people, man. I don't think, I mean, that they go around moping. Don't give them such ideas. I mean...
I have a lot of them at home.
The fact of the matter is, remember again your history. Not
That's
your
my
family.
Brother laughing out there, by the way.
No, but I mean, just remember where you come from, you know, and how you made it, you know. What's to stop you from doing it again? And you see, I mean, when you help the weak over there. I mean, it's inhibiting.
Okay.
I mean, I can't. No, the fact of the matter is, one, you've come from down there, you surprised the world, you emerged from the morass. The fact is that if you cut this budget, say you cut it in the recipient country, they now are not able to deal as effectively with AIDS as they used to. AIDS has an extraordinary cocktail with TB. Someone right away in the Bundus comes and works and cleans an aeroplane. And he's got TB, and he coughs, and the germs. You're not able to quarantine yourself from that disease over there. It's in your interest to ensure that those guys over there are healthy for your own sake.
That point's very well made. Now, listen, we just have time for a couple more questions before I invite some questions from the audience. But one question I've often wondered, or one thing I've often wondered, have you ever been afraid?
Yes. Oh, yes. But what I used to say, I mean, we knew that there were assassinations and things of that kind. We were not treated as badly as many others have been, but I mean, you got things, the kind of harassment where we would be sleeping and a car would stop outside our house and flash the lights. I mean, you know, when you're sleeping, you get that. So you have to wake up about 2 o'clock in the morning. The one time when I really got angry and near feeling that I couldn't forgive this is, you see your child answering the telephone, and then she seizes up, and it is somebody at the other end who's saying, tell your father we're going to kill him. Now, they were aware that, I mean, they're talking to a child, and you'd have thought they would say, call your father. But what I said, God, look here. If I'm doing your work, you jolly well are going to have to look after me. And it looks like it's not been too bad. Thank you. Thank you.
What a beautiful note on which to end. I'm going to hand you back now to Ian to finally wrap the proceedings and make a formal presentation.
Okay, before we move on to the presentation, just a couple of quick thank yous. I first would like to extend my and the LNH's deepest thanks to Sean O'Rourke for coming out and taking part in this interview. So thank you, Sean. I would also like to make reference and thank a very special guest, the Ambassador of South Africa to Ireland, Ambassador Janna. You are very welcome, and we're delighted to have you. Now, the Honorary Fellowship of the Literary and Historical Society is the highest honor that the Society can bestow on anyone, and is bestowed to individuals who have demonstrated the ability to profoundly impact the world for the better and to change the course of world history. Archbishop Desmond Tutu stands as one of the most impassioned, the most reasoned, and the most effective stalwart defenders of human rights we have ever seen. He has committed himself assiduously to bettering the lot of those who are oppressed in our world and making entrenched hatreds go away and be eroded. And I think he stands as an unbelievable inspiration to us all to know that we actually can come together and we can make things better. And it is for that fundamental reason that it is an unparalleled honor for me to present Archbishop Desmond Tutu with the Honorary Fellowship of the Literary and Historical Society.